Welcome to the Deep Dive, the only place you need to be to get a complete and granular understanding of what is actually happening in Washington, D.C. I'm Alex Johnson.
And I'm Sam Kennedy. Today, we have undertaken a massive, essential mission for you, our listener. This is the Federal News Update for Sunday, November 9th, 2025.
That title is precise. Our mission today isn't just, you know, skimming the headlines. We're aiming for an exhaustive, day-by-day, action-by-action report.
Every single move made by the U.S. federal government since the start of Friday, November 7th, 2025.
Exactly. Detailing the systematic implications of these actions, we're talking two full, pretty chaotic days of federal activity, or maybe inactivity, during what's now the longest government shutdown in U.S. history.
And when we synthesized all these sources, what emerged was, well, an extraordinary picture of modern American governance. It's a reality we've started calling the barbell state.
Right. Think of an actual barbell. You've got these two extremely heavy weights on either end, right? But they're connected by a center rod that's just collapsing.
Mm-hmm. So on one end, that collapsing center rod, that's your traditional government. You know, the administrative machinery, Congress, essential services like food aid, air traffic control.
That whole part is falling into, well, atrophy, dysfunction, operational paralysis, just grinding to a halt.
But the other end of the barbell, that side is hyperactive. It's intensely centralized, and it's rapidly consolidating immense high-stakes power. We're talking the executive and judicial branches.
And we saw huge things happening there, didn't we? Foreign policy shifts, big regulatory enforcement actions.
Absolutely. And foundational legal precedents suddenly thrown into immediate question.
Yeah.
All of this unfolding while the traditional government is technically, legally shut down. Quite something.
So let's unpack that collapse first. Let's start where the paralysis is maybe most acute. Day 38 of this record-breaking government shutdown.
38 days. I mean, just let that sink in. That means Congress, the legislative branch, has basically stopped functioning as a budgeting body.
They've put the basic operation of the government on ice, essentially, holding it hostage.
Pretty much. Over one single intractable policy dispute. Healthcare costs.
And that sticking point, the real core of the conflict, it's these enhanced Affordable Care Act premium tax credits, right?
Exactly. For listeners who follow this closely, these were the subsidies put in place during the pandemic era. They dramatically lowered health insurance costs, made coverage affordable for millions.
But they're scheduled to expire at the end of this year. That's the deadline looming.
And Senate Democrats have drawn a really firm red line on this. They're refusing to pass any funding bill, not even a temporary stopgap measure, unless those ACA subsidies are explicitly extended.
Their argument being, if they expire, it's catastrophic for millions of families.
Yes, and they argue, accurately, that letting those credits just vanish would be devastating for millions of middle and low-income families.
And when we say catastrophic, we should probably detail what that actually means for an average person who relies on these credits. It's not a small bump, is it?
No, not at all.
Yeah.
We're not talking about a small, you know, inflationary increase here. Sources are suggesting premiums could jump by 300%, maybe even quadruple for some individuals.
Quadruple? That makes coverage completely unaffordable for many.
Completely. It forces many people to just drop their insurance entirely, which then shifts the burden of their care onto, well, emergency rooms, state services.
Yeah.
It has huge ripple effects.
So those are the stakes, huge stakes. And Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer, he tried to break this logjam on November 7th and 8th.
He did. He offered what he termed a simple proposal. Essentially, two simultaneous votes.
Okay. What were the two votes?
One vote to reopen the government immediately, just, you know, turn the lights back on. And a second vote right after to extend those expiring ACA subsidies.
For how long?
Just for 1 year.
Okay. That sounds, well, pretty pragmatic on the surface. A compromise, maybe. Get the government running, avoid the immediate healthcare cliff.
It does sound pragmatic. But Senate Majority Leader John Thune immediately shot it down, called it a non-starter.
A non-starter? Why?
He stated firmly that any negotiation about the future of the ACA, its structure, all of that, it has to wait until the government is actually open and functioning normally.
But that position, it's not just coming from him, is it? There's influence from the top.
Exactly. This is where we see President Trump actively intervening, really shaping this legislative fight through political framing. He was on Truth Social over the weekend.
Right, I saw that. Characterizing the ACA in really harsh terms. Really bad Obamacare.
That's the phrase. And urging Senate Republicans point blank to reject any subsidy extensions.
But his counterproposal was interesting. It wasn't just no.
No. And this is where the political framing gets, well, pretty sophisticated. Genius, maybe, in its populism. He didn't just say reject the ACA subsidies.
What did he propose instead?
He proposed that instead of sending those billions in subsidy funds to, quote, fat cat insurance companies, the government should instead send the funds directly to the people.
Okay, let's unpack that. That's a pure populist play, isn't it?
Absolutely. It completely reframes the debate, takes it away from the Democrats' strong point protecting healthcare access, and shifts it squarely onto populist ground, cracking down on corporate villains, giving cash directly to consumers.
It's clever politics. But what about the policy reality? Could that even work quickly?
Well, that's the fascinating part, the gap between political efficacy and policy practicality. Politically, it's a home run. Sounds like a consumer handout, deregulation, all rolled into one.
But implementing it?
Policy-wise, it's incredibly dubious to implement immediately. These ACA subsidies are complex. They adjust based on income, family size, local insurance rates. It's intricate.
Right. You couldn't just flip a switch to direct cash payments.
No way. To suddenly switch to some kind of generalized direct cash payment system, you'd need massive new bureaucracy, huge IT infrastructure changes, negotiations with state exchanges. It simply couldn't happen fast enough to stop that premium spike.
But the rhetoric works. It achieves the political goal.
It does. It completely bypasses the actual healthcare defense debate. It changes the question.
From, are you saving my health insurance, to, are you cutting checks to insurance companies or to me?
Precisely. And that's the leverage point that's keeping this shutdown going.
Meanwhile, while that high-level fight is happening, Congress did make one attempt, right, to address the immediate suffering of federal employees on November 7th. They tried to pay the workforce.
Yes, there was an effort in the Senate. They tried to move on a bill called the Shutdown Fairness Act. This was a Republican initiative.
And the goal was simple: pay federal workers.
Yeah, it sought to pay federal employees, including military members, immediately. And importantly, backdated to October 1st, the start of the shutdown.
Okay, but then Senate Democrats block that motion. Why would they block a bill that just pays people who are clearly hurting? That seems like a terrible political position.
It was definitely a high-stakes legislative maneuver. Democrats blocked that straightforward GOP motion because they were demanding an alternative bill be considered instead.
An alternative bill? What was different?
Their bill included a crucial rider. It was called the Military and Federal Employee Protection Act. And what it did was clarify that the funds authorized to pay employees could not be used by the administration for other purposes.
Ah, so preventing the executive branch from sort of shifting money around, using the payroll bill to fund other priorities during the crisis.
Exactly. Preventing them from gaining discretionary spending power through what was supposed to be just a payroll bill. It really reflects the deep fundamental level of distrust right now.
Where even just paying federal workers becomes a legislative weapon.
Precisely. But what's maybe most telling about how much pain the workforce is in, the largest federal employee union, AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees, they actually came out and endorsed the Republican bill.
Really? Even without those protections?
After it was amended to include coverage for furloughed employees and federal contractors, yes. Their desperation, it seems, outweighed the procedural fight over potential fund misuse. They just needed the pay.
That desperation is palpable. And it was sort of formalized, wasn't it, on November 7th, with the bureaucracy confirming this isn't ending quickly.
Yeah, we saw the bureaucratic equivalent of admitting this crisis is dragging on. On November 7th, agencies like the IRS had to issue what's called a second furlough decision letter.
A second letter? Why was that needed? Don't people just stay furloughed?
Under federal law, those initial furlough notices, the ones sent out back in October, they're only legally effective for 30 days.
Ah, okay, so the 30 days ran out.
Right. Since the shutdown started October 1st, those notices expired. So agencies were legally required to issue a completely new set of legally binding decision letters to cover the next 30-day period.
And that action, getting a second letter, must be psychologically brutal for employees.
Absolutely critical. It moves the crisis from feeling like maybe a temporary political spat into a formalized long-term administrative reality. For the roughly 900,000 furloughed employees, getting that second letter just confirms the missed paycheck isn't a mistake. It's the ongoing structured reality.
And for the other 2 million essential personnel, military, air traffic controllers we'll talk about, they're now working well into their second missed paycheck cycle. Mm-hmm. No idea when they'll get paid. The financial strain must be immense.
And it's showing up in the hard data. We are seeing absolutely staggering evidence of financial distress among federal workers. Specifically, look at their retirement savings in the Thrift Savings Plan, the TSP.
The TSP, that's like the federal government's 401k, right?
Exactly. And the data for the last month, the signs of distress are just undeniable. Compared to the same time last year, loan requests where people borrow against their own retirement, they were up a massive 35%, nearly 50,000 requests.
Wow. Borrowing from their future selves.
And maybe even more concerning, outright withdrawals, just taking the money out, completely rose by 15%. That's 121,000 withdrawals.
So people aren't just borrowing, they're actually liquidating their retirement savings.
To cover basics, rent, utilities, food. The TSP board also reported a 23% spike in calls coming in. 183,000 people calling, almost certainly asking, how do I get my money?
And this strain, it moves way beyond just the individual employee, right? There's a macroeconomic cost to this paralysis, and some of it's permanent.
Huge cost. The Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, they ran the numbers. And they're sobering. The shutdown has already cut the overall gross domestic product, GDP, in this fourth quarter of 2025 by an estimated $18
billion. $18 billion just gone from the economy.
But here's the really critical analytical point.
Mm-hmm.
The CBO projects that between $7 billion and $14 billion of that lost economic output is permanently unrecoverable.
Permanently unrecoverable. That's important. Why isn't it just, you know, delayed spending that happens later?
Because it represents lost productivity. Work that just never got done. Furlough scientists didn't finish research. Inspectors didn't do safety checks. Administrators didn't process paperwork. That output, that value is lost forever.
It's not just about people waiting to spend their paychecks later. It's a real permanent scar.
A permanent scar on the nation's economic output caused entirely by governmental failure.
And that scar extends deep into the private sector too, doesn't it? Especially for businesses that rely on federal contracts or loans.
Absolutely. You've got over 5.2 million federal contractors who, unlike government employees, have no legal guarantee of back pay. They're incredibly vulnerable to mass layoffs right now.
And small businesses.
On a more local level, sources indicate that about 4,800 small businesses have been blocked from getting $2.5 billion in federally backed loans since this shutdown started.
These are small firms, probably outside the DC bubble, just needing capital.
Exactly. And they're starving for it because the government can't process a simple loan guarantee. It really shows how quickly the collapse of the legislative branch just trickles right down to Main Street.
Now, if we think about the workforce, not just as people waiting for paychecks, but as the actual machinery of the state, we have to talk about that major lawsuit filed by the federal unions on November 7th, the one about the administration's new merit hiring plan.
Yes, this is potentially one of the most significant structural challenges to the idea of a nonpartisan civil service that we've seen in decades.
But what's the core issue?
Unions, led by AFGE, are suing the administration over a new, apparently mandatory essay question that's showing up now on thousands of federal job applications.
An essay question? What does it ask?
It asks candidates to detail how they would advance the president's executive orders and policy priorities.
Wow. Okay, that sounds, well, it sounds like a political loyalty oath just dressed up as an essay question.
That is precisely the core argument the unions are making. They claim it violates the First Amendment free speech rights of applicants, that it forces them to voice support for the current administration's agenda or risk being filtered out.
The lawsuit literally says it's designed to weed out those who do not voice sufficient support for President Trump.
That's the language used, yes.
And what's the scale here? Is this just for high-level political jobs?
No, and that's what's really striking. This question has appeared on over 5,800 federal job applications so far. And critically, 1,700 of those job postings were actually published during the shutdown.
So even while furloughing people, they're posting jobs with this question. What kind of jobs?
They're incredibly wide-ranging and often seem to have zero policy relevance. Yes, roles as high as deputy undersecretaries, but also incredibly simple apolitical roles, like a meat-cutting worker job at the Defense Department or a laundry worker position at the VA.
A meat cutter has to explain how they'll advance the president's policy priorities.
According to the unions, yes. They emphasize that an applicant's political opinion is, quote, entirely unrelated to their ability to perform these kinds of career civil service jobs.
And the Office of Personnel Management, OPM, they're defending this.
They are. The OPM director, Scott Kupor, has put out statements defending the plan. He argues it actually reinforces the nonpartisan character of the workforce. He insists hiring managers can't consider political beliefs.
So he's saying the essays are just optional, informational.
He claims they're merely optional free response essay questions, just to gauge policy awareness. However, and this is a big sherbet, however, the OPM guidance also states that the answers will be reviewed by hiring managers and political appointees.
Ah, so if the essays truly have no bearing on who gets hired, why involve political appointees in reviewing them?
Exactly. That lack of clarity, that contradiction, is really what's fueling this lawsuit. It looks like a political screen, even if they say it isn't.
Okay, moving from getting a job to keeping your health benefits, federal employees have another massive, confusing burden hitting them right now. Open season.
Yeah, open season. That's the annual period where federal workers have to choose their health, dental, and vision benefits for the next year. And it kicks off Monday, November 10th.
Right in the middle of this shutdown chaos.
Think about that timing. Federal workers are forced to navigate these crucial, complex, high-cost decisions about their family's health care, while many are furloughed, or working without pay, or, as we just discussed, maybe dipping into their retirement savings just to get by.
And they're making these choices against a backdrop of financial pain, plus facing the second straight year of double-digit premium hikes in the Federal Employee Health Benefits Program, the FEHB.
That's right. But what's making this year particularly, potentially devastating for tens of thousands of families is a specific administrative action OPM took regarding default enrollment.
Default enrollment? What happened there?
One of the really large plans, the NALC plan, that's the one sponsored by the National Association of Letter Carriers Union, it's dropping out of the federal side of the program. It's leaving FEHB.
Okay, so OPM had to pick a replacement plan for everyone enrolled in that NALC plan if they didn't actively choose a new one.
Exactly. They had to choose a default.
Now, normally, isn't the rule that if people don't actively choose, they get defaulted into the lowest cost nationwide option available to protect them?
That's usually a regulation, yes. To default into the lowest cost sensible option. But what did OPM choose this year?
What did they choose?
That's where the controversy is. OPM invoked a clause allowing them to designate an alternate default. And they chose the higher premium GEHA high plan as the default.
Wait, the higher premium plan, not the lowest cost.
Correct. So imagine someone who was previously enrolled in a low cost, maybe consumer-driven health plan. If they miss the deadline, maybe because they're furloughed or just overwhelmed by the shutdown,
they get automatically put into this expensive GEHA high plan.
Yes. This automatic passive enrollment into a high premium plan means they could face an instantaneous massive spike in their healthcare costs, potentially thousands of dollars more per year, unless they actively log in during this chaos and choose a cheaper alternative themselves.
So just to be clear, an employee working without pay, stressed, maybe misses the open season deadline. And because they were in a low-cost plan that's leaving, they could suddenly be auto-assigned to a plan that costs, what, maybe $7,500 more per year for their family?
That's exactly the kind of scenario experts are warning about. They're issuing urgent warnings that this passive enrollment could be financially ruinous for thousands of households. It puts a massive additional financial strain on a workforce already in crisis.
It feels like an administrative decision with potentially cruel real-world consequences.
It really does. And we should also quickly note, there are political and social policy changes embedded just in the standard FEHB coverage for next year, too.
Oh, like what?
Well, there are some program-wide changes worth highlighting. For instance, PrEP medications, the ones used for HIV prevention, they're now required coverage across all plans. That's a major public health win.
Okay, that's positive.
But conversely, certain gender-affirming care treatments have been removed from standard coverage. That's a significant policy shift, likely rooted in conservative political pressure.
In IVF.
In vitro fertilization coverage for infertility treatment, that continues to be covered. So you see these specific coverage decisions happening. It shows that even during a shutdown, these social and health policy choices are being made and enforced through these administrative channels.
That actually sets the stage perfectly for the next part of our barbell analogy, the operational breakdown. We've established the workforce is collapsing under the strain, but that paralysis also created immediate physical chaos. Mm. And we saw that chaos erupt in the skies, and maybe most tragically, in food aid.
Yeah, the FAA mandate that was implemented on November 7th, that's probably the clearest, most visible sign that the government's basic operational safety net is just gone.
The Federal Aviation Administration, under DOT, they issued an emergency order.
Yes, mandating a systematic 10% reduction in all daily scheduled domestic flight operations.
10% across 40 high-impact airports. We're talking JFK, LaGuardia, Atlanta, DFW, Chicago. That cripples the national air travel system.
It is absolutely unprecedented. And the stated reason, according to DOT Secretary Sean Duffy, was purely safety-based.
Safety. Because of the shutdown.
Yes. The administration openly admitted that air traffic controllers, the ATCs, they're essential employees. They're forced to work without pay. The FAA cited persistent staffing shortages, dangerously increased ATC fatigue, and crucially, a rising number of voluntary safety reports coming in from pilots.
Pilots were reporting concerns.
Yes, concerned about tired, stressed out controllers in the towers. They essentially had to ground planes because the human element of the system, the workforce, was collapsing under the strain.
Just imagine being that air traffic controller, running on fumes, making life or death decisions constantly in a super high stress job, knowing one mistake is disaster. And you haven't had a paycheck in 5 weeks.
It's an impossible situation.
Yep.
So the FAA had to artificially lower the system's capacity just to maintain basic safety standards.
It was a deliberate trade-off then. Economic efficiency versus human safety.
Exactly. A calculated decision. The cuts started smaller. At 4% on November 7th, they're scheduled to ramp up incrementally to the full 10% by November 14th.
But the immediate impact was still chaos.
Oh, absolutely. Over 1,000 flights were canceled just on Friday, November 7th. By Saturday, November 8th, that number had climbed to over 1,460 canceled flights nationwide. Just pure chaos for travelers.
And if this legislative paralysis continues, what does this mean for Thanksgiving travel? That's just around the corner.
Secretary Duffy warned publicly about that. He said if the shutdown continues without a resolution, these flight cuts could increase, maybe to 15%, possibly even 20%.
20%, that would be devastating for Thanksgiving. Millions stranded, billions in economic disruption.
It would be absolutely devastating. And we also need to remember the sort of ancillary workforce caught in this. Think about flight attendants.
Right, they're getting paid by the airlines, but...
But they're dealing with massive morale erosion, constant last-minute schedule changes, cancellations, dealing with stressed passengers, and operating in a system where they know the safety margins are thinner because of the stress on the ATCs. The Association of Professional Flight Attendants highlighted this. The chaos hits everyone touching the skies.
So the paralysis in the skies is structural. It's about system capacity. But the paralysis over food aid... That was immediate, incredibly high stakes, and it played out in real time in the courts, didn't it, on November 7th?
Yes. Let's walk through the truly chaotic timeline of that judicial battle over SNAP benefit. It was both a legal crisis and a humanitarian one.
We're talking about the $9 billion November payment for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, food stamps for 42 million low-income Americans.
Exactly. The conflict kicked off when the Trump administration refused to disperse the full $9 billion. They cited the shutdown as the reason. They only offered $4 billion, which they said they scraped together from some small contingency fund. It would have meant severely partial benefits for everyone.
So, millions of Americans were suddenly facing a huge cut in their food budgets just days before the benefits were supposed to arrive.
Yes, that's when the courts intervened dramatically. On November 7th, Federal District Judge John J. McConnell Jr. ordered the administration to release the full payment. He ruled their contingency plan was, quote, arbitrarily and capriciously created.
And the administration fought back immediately.
Instantly. They sought a stay, arguing the judge was overreaching, interfering with executive functions. But the U.S. Court of Appeals for the First Circuit denied that stay request early the same morning. They upheld Judge McConnell's order.
So by Friday morning, states knew they had a legal green light, a mandate even, to act fast, to get the full benefits out.
It became a frantic race against the clock. All through the day on November 7th, state governments, California, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Oregon, were key examples. They literally worked through the night, as reports said. They scrambled to process the necessary drawdowns from the Treasury and issue the full November benefits to their SNAP recipients.
Their speed basically saved millions from an immediate hunger crisis.
It absolutely did. Their quick action averted disaster for their residents.
But the administration didn't give up fighting the order, did they?
No. The legal battle went all the way to the top. Around 7 p.m. Eastern time that evening, the administration filed an emergency application with the Supreme Court.
And the Supreme Court acted quickly.
Extremely quickly. Just 2.5 hours later, around 9:30 p.m. Eastern, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, acting alone on the emergency docket, granted an administrative stay.
A stay.
Which means...
That single action immediately halted Judge McConnell's order. It froze everything.
The legal whiplash must have been incredible. But what was the devastating real-world consequence of that 9:30 p.m. stay?
It instantly created this grossly inequitable two-tier welfare system, literally overnight.
How so? The remaining funds, about $4 billion that hadn't been drawn down yet, were frozen instantly. that blocked payments for millions of recipients in states that just hadn't managed to process them in time before that 9.3Z deadline. States like North Carolina, Colorado, others.
So a family's ability to buy food in November was literally determined by how fast their state's IT system could process a payment before a Supreme Court justice issued a stay at 9:30 at night.
That is the absurd, almost cruel reality of the system failing right at that critical state-federal interface, purely based on timing and bureaucratic speed.
And this raises that fundamental question we touched on earlier, the separation of powers. The Supreme Court is now stepping into what looks like a congressional appropriations dispute. Isn't that something the court usually tries to avoid?
Absolutely. It's deep in the political thicket, which they normally steer clear of. The administration's core legal argument, the one Justice Jackson's stay temporarily seemed to endorse, is that the district court was engaging in judicial activism.
By telling the executive branch how to spend money?
Essentially, yes. Claiming the judge was trying to dictate how federal funds should be spent during a shutdown. The executive branch is basically claiming it has sole unchallengeable discretion over how, when, and even if appropriations are spent during a crisis like this.
And the fact the Supreme Court is even considering refereeing this fight.
It signals that the judiciary has become the default battleground for these huge political fights that Congress has simply abandoned its responsibility to resolve.
Okay, let's pivot now. Let's flip the barbell to the other side, the hyperactive executive. While Congress is paralyzed and essential services are literally crumbling,
right,
the executive branch seems fully functional, pushing aggressive policy, consolidating power both globally and right here at home.
The events of November 7th really showcase this. The executive branch operating with extraordinary efficiency and maybe a ruthless transactional focus. Let's start with foreign policy. President Trump and Secretary of State Marco Rubio hosted Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban for a high-level summit.
And this meeting, it was defined by pure transactional realism, wasn't it? A trade-off.
Exactly. The U.S. gave a geopolitical concession in exchange for a long-term strategic commercial win.
What was the concession? What did the U.S. give?
The give was granting Hungary a crucial one-year exemption from U.S. sanctions on Russian oil and gas imports.
That's big. That was Orban's primary goal, wasn't it? Securing Hungary's energy supply.
His primary immediate goal, yes. Securing his nation's energy supply and maybe gaining some political leverage against Moscow, too. The U.S. essentially decided to prioritize a strategic pivot over maintaining strict adherence to the sanctions regime in this case.
Okay, so that was the give. What was the strategic get for the U.S.? It's centered on nuclear energy, I understand.
Exactly. In exchange for that sanctions carve-out, Hungary signed a memorandum of understanding, an MOU, to buy U.S. nuclear fuel from Westinghouse for the first time ever to power their existing Russian-built Paksai nuclear plant.
So starting to wean Hungary off Russian nuclear fuel.
That's the critical first step, beginning that process of reducing Hungary's energy-driven reliance on Moscow. But even more significantly, the agreement sets up a framework for cooperation on small modular reactors, SMRs.
The next generation of nuclear tech.
Right. Hungary signaled its intent to support the construction of up to 10 U.S.-designed SMRs. That's a potential multi-billion dollar deal stretching over a decade for American industry. It really secures U.S. energy influence in a key NATO state for the long term.
So the administration basically secured a long-term commercial foothold in Central Europe by strategically trading a short-term sanctions waiver. Smart politics, maybe? Was there also an ideological piece to this meeting?
There definitely was. The leaders also established a $1 million joint research consortium. The stated goal is to study the ethical use of AI.
Okay, but the details matter here, right? Where's the money going?
It's being channeled specifically through two religious universities, the Catholic University of America here in the U.S. and Pázmány Péter Catholic University in Hungary.
That seems like a very deliberate political choice.
Oh, absolutely. It signals a concerted effort to create a parallel track for AI governance, a conservative, values-based track, one that's intentionally separate from the more secular, highly regulatory frameworks being developed over in Brussels by the European Union. It's like an ideological alliance being cemented with research dollars.
Okay, let's shift back to domestic policy, because the executive branch was simultaneously taking aggressive populist actions right here at home on November 7th, starting with the price of groceries.
Yeah, President Trump directed the Department of Justice, the DOJ, to immediately begin an investigation into the big four meat packers. That's JBS, Tyson, Cargill, and National Beef.
And the allegations.
Illicit collusion, price fixing, and price manipulation.
Okay, this feels like classic pocketbook populism, doesn't it? A high-profile move targeting rising beef prices, which have been a major complaint for American consumers.
Absolutely. The political goal is immediate and very clear. Show that the administration is actively protecting American consumers from what the White House release called foreign-dominated monopolies.
Did it have an immediate effect?
The market reacted instantly. Shares of JBS and Tyson Foods dropped pretty sharply right after the announcement. But here's the key analytical point to grasp.
Book that.
This action represents a stark 180-degree policy reversal. Just a short while ago, the president had actually suggested importing cheap Argentine beef to lower consumer prices here.
Right, a classic free market solution.
Exactly. So pivoting now to a nationalistic antitrust investigation. That's a significant political shift away from free trade principles toward much more populist interventionism in the market.
The political win is just making the announcement, really, regardless of whether the DOJ actually finds a solid case down the road.
That's often how these things work, yes.
But the executive branch's consolidation of power wasn't just limited to the price of steaks, was it? It reached deep into higher education, too, through that settlement with Cornell University.
Yes, this Cornell settlement is a really critical new template. It shows how the executive branch can enforce its social policy agenda without needing any legislative action from a paralyzed Congress.
So what happened? On November 7th, the White House announced a historic settlement with Cornell. This followed accusations about alleged racial discrimination and anti-Semitism on campus.
Correct. Those were the initial hooks for the federal scrutiny.
And what were the terms of this settlement? It wasn't just a fine, right?
No. Cornell, while importantly not admitting any wrongdoing, agreed to pay $30 million to the U.S. Treasury. They also committed another $30 million for agricultural research, which aligns with Cornell's strengths.
Okay, so $60 million total. But what was the crucial policy piece? The mechanism?
The crucial part was this. Cornell agreed to adopt the Department of Justice's anti-DEI guidance, Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, as a mandatory training resource for all faculty and staff.
Mandatory training based on DOJ guidance?
Yeah.
And anything else?
Yes, they also have to provide anonymized undergraduate admissions data to the federal government every quarter.
So basically, they're letting the DOJ dictate internal university governance, policy, and data sharing. What did Cornell get in return from the administration?
This is the transactional part. In exchange for agreeing to all this, the government immediately restored over $250 million in federal research grants that had been frozen or paused by the administration. And they closed all the pending Title VI and Title IX civil rights investigations against the university.
Wow. So the administration used the threat of investigations and withholding huge amounts of central research funding
to essentially coerce a private institution into complying with its anti-DEI agenda. It's a fundamental shift. It's non-legislative. The executive branch is effectively rewriting university policy using financial leverage without Congress needing to debate or pass a single law.
That consolidation of power, that executive action, it extends directly into national security, too. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth gave a major policy speech on November 7th, declaring the end of an era for defense.
Yeah, Hegseth's speech, which he titled The Arsenal of Freedom, was delivered to a huge audience of defense industry leaders, acquisition professionals. Mm. His central quote was incredibly definitive, dramatic even. He said, "The defense acquisition system as you know it is dead."
Dead. Why?
He argued the current system, the one that emphasizes these really high-cost, slow-to-develop, super-exquisite platforms, is just far too slow. He said it lacks the scalable capacity needed to deal with modern high-tempo threats, and he specifically cited pure competition with China as the driver.
So if the old system is dead, what's the replacement doctrine he laid out?
The new doctrine, he said, prioritizes three things: speed, modularity, and competition.
Speed, modularity, competition. What does that mean in practice?
He promised a creation of a brand new wartime production unit inside the Pentagon, specifically designed to streamline procurement, cut red tape. And he delivered a very direct, stark warning to the major defense contractors in the audience. Essentially, adapt or fade away.
So signaling a profound shift away from that traditional, maybe comfortable defense industry oligopoly.
Towards a system built for rapid, maybe more decentralized innovation. Something maybe mirroring a faster-paced tech industry model built for high-tempo conflict.
And this wasn't just talk, right? On the very same day, the Army put this new vision into immediate action.
That's right. It shows they're serious. The Army issued a new broad agency announcement, a BAA. For the listener, a BAA isn't like a traditional contract bid. It's a fast-track competitive request for industry to submit research proposals.
And this BAA was for what?
It was for a program called SPEED, which stands for Supplemental Power, Efficient Engines, and Drives.
Okay, SPEED. What kind of tech is that targeting?
This program specifically seeks R&D for advanced AI-driven rotorcraft drive systems for both manned helicopters and unmanned drones.
Ah, so AI-driven helicopters and drones. That perfectly matches Hegseth's new vision. Modular, high-tech, competitively sourced R&D, replacing those slow, traditional acquisition pipelines.
Exactly. It's rhetoric immediately followed by bureaucratic action aligned with that rhetoric.
Now, if we connect this defense transformation to the broader geopolitical picture, we also saw a rare moment of de-escalation with China, didn't we? Focused specifically on the fentanyl crisis.
Yes, that was also on November 7th. Executive Order 14357 was formally published then, though it was signed a few days earlier on November 4th.
And this order did what?
It actually reduced tariffs on certain Chinese goods, lowered them from 20% down to 10%. That's a rare, explicit economic concession in the current climate.
Why the reduction? What was the reasoning given?
The order explicitly states it's a reciprocal action because, quote, the People's Republic of China has committed to take significant measures to end the flow of fentanyl to the United States.
So using tariffs as a carrot, not just a stick.
Exactly. It highlights this calculated transactional duality in the administration's foreign policy. They're willing to use tariffs not just as a punitive weapon in a trade war, but also as an economic bargaining chip, trading a commercial concession for cooperation on a high-priority domestic security issue like the opioid crisis.
So even as the administrative end of the barbell is collapsing, the enforcement arm of the executive branch seems to be operating at full tilt. What were key agencies like Homeland Security doing publicly during the shutdown?
Well, the Department of Homeland Security, DHS, their public messaging on November 7th was exclusively focused on enforcement activities. That's all they talked about.
Like what kind of enforcement?
They were actively promoting arrests of, quote, worst of the worst criminal illegal aliens, highlighting individuals charged with serious crimes. They were also touting high application numbers for certain enforcement programs.
So basically sending a message.
A very deliberate message. Core immigration enforcement functions, the ones deemed essential, are completely insulated from the shutdown's fiscal problems. They're operating normally, even hyperactively.
And we also saw a specific deregulatory move filed in the Federal Register that day.
Yes. The Departments of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, and Agriculture, USDA, jointly filed a notice. It provided an additional extension of HUD compliance dates.
Compliance dates for what?
For new energy efficiency standards for federally financed housing. This is basically a deregulatory move. It was immediately praised by the National Association of Home Builders.
Why did they like it?
They argued that delaying these, quote, costly environmental mandates would ease the financial burden on builders and potentially help lower housing costs, at least in the short term, by pushing back these green requirements.
So, okay. On one side of the barbell, paralyzing cuts to paychecks, food stamps in jeopardy, planes grounded. And on the other side, hyperactive enforcement, major foreign policy pivots, swift deregulation, reshaping education and defense. It's quite the contrast.
It really is. Which brings us squarely to that second heavyweight of the barbell, the judiciary, which, as we've touched on, seems to have become the default policy battleground for everything else.
The judiciary is just under an unsustainable political burden right now, isn't it?
Completely. The Supreme Court held its first private conference since mid-October back on November 7th. And the agenda, the cases they were considering granting review to, it contained petitions that signal the court is actively willing to destabilize foundational social and legal policy in this country.
Which cases really stand out as the most potentially destabilizing?
Well, the first one is a case called Davis v. Ermold. This petition explicitly asks the court to review and overturn Obergefell v. Hodges.
Obergefell, that's the 2015 decision that legalized same-sex marriage nationwide. They're asking the court to overturn that.
Explicitly. The fact that a direct challenge to Obergefell, which felt like a foundational modern rights precedent, is even being seriously considered for review by the court, that in itself is a major, profoundly destabilizing development.
It confirms that the consensus around certain fundamental rights is no longer considered settled law, at least by the judiciary.
Exactly. The legal theory behind such challenges often revolves around whether the court overstepped its authority back in 2015 or maybe originalist readings of the 14th Amendment. But regardless of the legal theory, just the impact of the court granting review would be immense, sending shockwaves.
And there's another major case on the docket, too.
Yes. Noam V. L. Otrolato. This one challenges the definition of when exactly an asylum seeker is deemed to have officially arrived in the United States.
That sounds technical, but I imagine the implications are huge.
Absolutely fundamental. It impacts the rights asylum seekers have, the timing of their processing, basically every asylum claim made at the border. Both these cases, Davis and Noam, they position the court to be the ultimate arbiter of the nation's most divisive social and legal questions. They're filling that void left by a paralyzed Congress.
However, on that very same day, November 7th, the judiciary also showed it could still act as a crucial check on executive power, right? Showing the tensions even within the judicial branch itself.
Absolutely. Down in Portland, Oregon, U.S. District Court Judge Corinne Immergut issued a really significant ruling. It was a permanent injunction.
That blocking.
Blocking the administration from federalizing and deploying the National Guard to the city of Portland.
That feels like a major check on the president's power. His discretion to use military force for domestic law enforcement and potentially bypassing state governors?
It's huge. Judge Immergut ruled definitively. She said the president did not have a lawful basis to federalize the National Guard in that instance. She explicitly affirmed 10th Amendment rights, the ones reserving powers not delegated to the federal government to the states.
So it directly rebukes the administration's claim that it had unilateral authority because Portland was supposedly some kind of war zone.
Correctly. And it creates this remarkable tension just on a single day. You have the Supreme Court intervening to essentially uphold executive discretion over spending in the SNAP case.
Right. With Justice Jackson's stay.
While simultaneously, a district court massively curtailed executive discretion over military power in that Portland case. It shows the judiciary itself is a contested space.
And we also saw a key decision affecting tribal sovereignty coming out of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals on November 7th.
Yes, that was the case. MAV Bisignano. The Ninth Circuit ruled against a tribal owned corporation. This corporation was trying to enforce its own cigarette tax laws on tribal land.
Okay, why did the court rule against them?
The court's reasoning was pretty nuanced, but the impact is significant. It found that the tribal-owned corporation was not legally synonymous with the tribe itself when it came to jurisdiction. So the court kicked the case back down to California State Court.
What are the deeper implications there for tribal sovereignty? That sounds like a blow.
It really is a blow, especially to tribal commerce. Tribal enterprises rely heavily on that shield of federal court jurisdiction. It protects their sovereign economic activities from state taxation, state interference.
So by ruling that the corporate structure weakened that shield,
the Ninth Circuit basically made it harder for tribal-owned businesses to assert their sovereignty and enforce their own laws without getting dragged into state legal systems, which are often less favorable.
Okay, so let's try to bring those two ends of the barbell back together now. We've looked at the collapsing center and the hyperactive ends. What does this comprehensive, really granular picture of just 2 days, November 7th and 8th, reveal about the state of governance right now?
I think the events undeniably confirm that this barbell state model is the operating reality. On one end, you have the administrative and legislative state actively failing. Congress paralyzed over ACA subsidies.
The workforce suffering through a formalized second furlough.
The FAA grounding planes because the system can't handle the strain. The Supreme Court intervening minute by minute to block food aid payments. It's systemic collapse on that side.
On the other end,
the executive and judicial powers are aggressively consolidating authority and executing major policy shifts, almost in a vacuum created by the legislative failure.
The executive unilaterally reshaping foreign policy with Hungary.
Revolutionizing defense acquisition with the Hague-Seth Doctrine.
Intervening in industrial policy with that DOJ meat probe.
And coercively reforming social policy in higher education through the Cornell settlement. It's all happening via executive action.
And the central unavoidable consequence of all this legislative paralysis, it's that the judiciary is just overwhelmed. Forced to make political decisions by default.
Completely overwhelmed and forced into that role. In just a single 48-hour period, think about what the courts were forced to rule on. Food aid for 42 million Americans. The president's power to deploy the military domestically. Tax collection laws regarding tribal sovereignty. And the potential future status of same-sex marriage in America.
These are massive fundamental questions, and historically, constitutionally, they were supposed to be resolved through that messy, slow, contentious process in Congress, right? Legislation, debate, compromise, appropriations.
Exactly. Not arbitrated by a single judicial officer working late on a Friday night like we saw with that SNAP decision.
Yeah.
The long-term implication here is profound.
What is it?
It's the realization that a significant truly high-stakes portion of U.S. governance is now structurally decoupled from the appropriations process. It doesn't matter if the government is shut down.
When the core administrative government shuts down, when paychecks stop, the biggest policy decisions, from trade tariffs to fundamental social rights to military readiness, they just continue unabated.
Decided by executive fiat and judicial review, rather than by the elected representatives in Congress.
That really sets up a truly provocative thought for you, our listener, to consider as we close out this deep dive. Secretary Hegseth's new defense doctrine. He formally declared the post-Cold War acquisition system dead. He wants to prioritize speed, modularity, competition, putting the system on what he called wartime footing.
Right.
So if this vision of a radically new arsenal of freedom built on things like AI-driven R&D, rapid production units, if that's fully realized by this hyperactive executive branch, what does that aggressive overhaul actually mean for America's role in future conflicts? And how quickly could U.S. defense technology, especially in areas like drone acquisition, AI integration, how quickly could it potentially surpass our rivals?
It really forces us to ask a fundamental question. Can the rapid, centralized, almost wartime-like action we're seeing from the executive branch and the Defense Department, can it successfully compensate for the simultaneous collapse of the legislative branch when it comes to maintaining national security, industrial readiness in the 21st century?
It's like the overall stability of the state is weakening, but its concentrated muscle mass is actually increasing.
That's a good way to put it. A very complex, maybe unstable picture.
We leave you with those thoughts and that complex picture of the barbell state. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into the federal news update. We'll be here when the next big story breaks.